I do love coming to this weird and wonderful place. I mean that in all affection. I love getting that call from Ed or from Brenda saying, could you come and talk? We've been thinking about compassion, but yet it's also Christmas, and we love it when you do something comparative. So I'm like, okay, I got to put all these ingredients in the slow cooker for a little while. So it's been in the slow cooker for the last few weeks here. And whenever I get that call, I hear the music for Mission Impossible cue up, you know. It's like, your mission, should you choose to accept, is to talk about all of these things. Yeah. I've also figured out, you know, at Starbucks, every single adjective that they put in front of a drink is an extra dollar. So every single ingredient that should get at least 10 more minutes to be able to talk to you guys. Okay, so here's my title, Peace on Earth and Goodwill to All. Everybody knows how the rest of it goes.
Yes.
Sentient beings, Christmas, compassion, and the Bodhisattva vow. All right. I fell in love with religious traditions kind of at an early age. Where, because I grew up in India, I didn't have Marvel comic books or DC comic books, so like I can't be bothered with the latest superhero movie. There's just like this a glut in the market. But I grew up on comic books of the Hindu gods and goddesses and stories of Buddha and everything. And so you know the stories that you have as a kid, they stay with you. You know, they become part of your heart. And they become part of your heart language, right? So I guess that just kind of continued on into my adult years. I was like, if I could study anything, it would be religious traditions. Why? Because I love trying to understand how people inhabit their world. There's nothing more interesting to me than that, you know? Because everybody, I mean, we talk about worldview, but it's like how people see and understand this their cosmos. Right, and sometimes they're just worlds apart, you know, the way people talk and the way people think, but what I love to do is try to find bridges between them, and that's what being a third culture kid's about. And I think that's why I love coming here, because I feel like, hey, this is my tribe of people. The other thing is, I think of religious traditions as being, you go to the next one, as being, they began in time, but they weren't kind of fully complete packages. Like it was something, and something that I would kind of describe as being like a watershed, or like a depth charge, or like a ripple effect, right? Because what happens is it's something miraculous and revolutionary that changed things, the experience of which would be felt for many centuries after that. Right. So I think of that as like a watershed, is like the high point in a on the land where the water drains in different directions, right? So I think about, you know, the life of Jesus as being like a watershed, or the life of Buddha as being like that drop in the pond, and then the ripples go up from there. So the rest of these remaining centuries and millennia are us trying to figure out what happened, right? Because something exciting happened. So, I'm going to tie into the story of the Buddha and then bring it back around to the Christmas story. So, Buddha, as you know, started off as Siddhartha Gautama, and he was a young prince who was very disillusioned by the life of luxury, and he ended up going out into the forest where all good and wonderful, amazing things happen in Indian traditions. And he tried starving himself. He was living on a few grains of rice per day, and there are icons of him just looking gaunt, skeletal, hollowed out features. And the story goes that he was so weak he couldn't even get out of the water after trying to bathe himself. So a young girl from the village, she nursed him back to health, and he decided, the answer to suffering is neither in the luxury of the palace, nor is it in the increased suffering of trying to starve myself in extreme asceticism. So it's in the middle way. The middle way is the way of meditation and the way of ethical practice. So here we are, next slide. This is the threshold of Bodhiana. Bodhiana is enlightenment. So the Siddhartha, who's still Prince Siddhartha at this point, he resolves to meditate under the tree of knowledge until he gets the answer to his main problematic, which is suffering. Why is there suffering in the world? Why do creatures suffer? Why do sentient beings suffer? And he sits there, and he sits there, and he sits there. And finally, next slide, according to tradition, the full moon night of May, and a lot of people try to date this, and so the kind of more consensus date is 528 BCE. And this is the night that he gained enlightenment, and according to tradition, it happened in three watches at night. So the first watch, Siddhartha understood all at once all of the, he could perceive all of his previous lifetimes, right, all the previous births. And if you see in this picture here, around the picture, around Buddha, there are gods and human beings and animals. And these are the collected stories that would later be known as the Jataka tales. And these are the comic books that I read growing up. And they're kind of like Buddhist Aesop's fables, right? So you grew up in Aesop's fables, there were stories about foxes and crows and all that. In India, the Jataka tales are the, you know, they're stories about deers and rabbits and, you know, like it's just, and it's all little moral lessons, you know, that all the character that went into the ethical practice that would eventually become the Buddha. But this is also the beginnings of the idea of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the idea, and initially in classical Buddhism, Buddha was the Bodhisattva. There's only one Bodhisattva, right? So he was the one who was on course to become the enlightened one, but remains within the karmic existence of samsara, and continued until he gained enlightenment. Okay, next one. The second watch of the night, he knew and understood all at once all the mechanics of karma and samsara. He understood why people are trapped from, you know, causal thoughts, words, and deeds, what ties this birth to the next. This birth writes the recipe for the next birth, right? And again, it goes around and round and round and round and round. And he understood it all at once, and also how to get out of it. He uses Hindu concepts, karma and samsara, but he radically changes them. Right? So a lot of people, when they say, oh, Hinduism, Buddhism teaching basically the same thing, you have no clue, right? Because actually there's a huge difference between Hindu reincarnation and Buddhist rebirth. That's a story for another time. Also, karma and samsara. What Buddha did, and this is where I think, this is like the depth charge that was ignited in the Indian traditions, he ethicized the universe. Before Buddha, it was very much a ritualistic universe, right? All the Vedas, the Upanishads, everything's oriented around the sacred fire and the priest, but Buddha ethicized the universe. This is the depth charge that went out, and we're still experiencing the effects of that. Next one, please. And then the third watch of the night, he knew and understood the Dharma. What is the Dharma? Well, in classical Indian Buddhism, the Dharma is the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Three Universals. Again, that's a story for another time. But yes, it is a beautiful thing. And the lotus becomes the symbol for Buddhism and for the Dharma. Why? Because out of the mud and the muck and the mire grows the beauty of the Dharma. What is the muck and the mire? Suffering. Is dukkha, right? There's so much more there. Next one, please. Now, he faced huge temptations there at the Bodhi tree, right? And according to tradition, there's an evil being called Mara. And Mara sent all these kind of like forms, magical forms to tempt him. and he was tempted with desire, comma, he was tempted. This is a temptation for him. Okay, now you've got your answer, now just die and go. Right? So that was an actual temptation that he had to face. And the other was, remember, he was a prince. Right? So according to caste, he was supposed to take over his father's throne. Right? So what are you doing out here pretending that you're some sort of holy man? Right? Go back to your home, go back and do your duty based on caste. And Buddha, there's this beautiful moment. It's like, you know, Jesus in the wilderness. It's like in the Matrix, it's Neo talking to the agents, right? And next one. And it's called the Bhumisparsha Mudra. He puts his finger on the ground, right? So when you see icons or statues of Buddha at the Bodhi tree, you'll see him touching the ground like that. It's called the earth touching gesture. So he doesn't even answer to all these temptations. He just touches the ground and the earth shakes and says, I, the earth, the mother of all things, bear witness that this is the enlightened one. Right, it's this great, powerful moment. All right, next one. Now you have the Hindu gods coming in. Okay, so the Hindu gods are not absent from the Buddhist story. Right, because you've got Indra and you've got Brahma, who are like the two chief gods in the Vedic pantheon. And they come and they plead with the enlightened one. And they say, you alone can destroy birth and death. I fall at your feet and implore you in the name of all the gods. Teach this Dharma. Right? So he's said, I'm going to remain. I'm going to teach this Dharma. He's achieved enlightenment. So he has nirvana. But with remainder. What does that mean? It means the fuel is almost burned up. There's still the smoke. There's still the embers. Right? Almost burned up. But still, the event has happened. The depth charge has gone off. Make sense? Next one, please. We're going to fast forward.
Can we
sing? Yeah, you're fine. Yeah, so fast forward 50 years in a place called Kushinagar. And here you have the final departure of the Buddha, where he achieves nirvana without remainder. Right? So all the fuel has been burned. And so off he goes. The final words of the Buddha were, all compounded things are ephemeral, like mayflies, right? Work diligently on your salvation. When he says all compounded things, he means yourself. Because what you think is the soul is actually an aggregate of five things. It's called the skandhas. That's a story for another time. So there's, you can see there's just so much embedded in all these ideas there. And really to have to take your time to learn a tradition. Now, in classical Buddhism, there are four stages to get you to the goal of enlightenment. And they are the stream winner, the once returner, the non-returner, and then ultimately to be an arhata. An arhata is a deserving one. He's the one who's like he merits now enlightenment. Okay, but look at the whole kind of progression of this, right? It's still very much the individual self on course to enlightenment. What's happening in the Buddhist traditions at the time, and it takes several centuries, is, next one? Sorry, that was the next one. I'm just going to kind of keep moving here because I got a lot. Within the next few centuries, you get people asking, what are those central questions? So if I, as an individual, set as my course to gain enlightenment, and I go through these non-returner, once-returner, you know, stream-winner, all these stages, so I can eventually become a deserving one, which is an arhata, that's the highest goal of classical Buddhism, isn't that in and of itself still a self-centered pursuit? Right? Because, hey, I just want to be free of my suffering, and so for me to attain enlightenment is to get free of my suffering and to enter whatever nirvana is. And Buddha very famously never really explains nirvana because you can't really say what it is. You can only really say what it isn't. But people are asking this question, and it is the question at the heart of classical Buddhism. Right? So good for you. You've attained all this, but to what end? Right? You are still, in a sense, pursuing this from a self-centered sort of perspective. And so, Now we've got the next one, the Bodhisattva. Okay, so this is where, a few centuries after classical Buddhism, now there's a new ideal that comes in. Remember, Buddha was the Bodhisattva. Now with Mahayana, you have any number of beings can become Bodhi beings, and Bodhi beings then actually choose to remain within the karmic grounds, within samsara, in order to do what? To help all sentient beings gain enlightenment. Right? So you can see how it's like taking that whole, that initial question, right? Isn't that a self-centered pursuit? And says, yes, that is. That's why we are calling upon all Bodhi beings to, out of compassion, choose to stay. And in staying, they become those who help, right? Help others gain enlightenment. So Bodhisattva is one who has attained Bodhicitta, the Buddha mind, and who has made the compassionate vow to remain and help all other sentient beings gain enlightenment. Okay, now because these have the powers of Buddhas, next one, since Bodhisattvas can help, they now become objects of devotion, objects of worship. Okay, so you can see how classical Buddhism has shifted, has moved through this Mahayana form, right? It's taken like five or six centuries to kind of develop this. Right, next one. And you've got these new texts that come and appear almost out of nowhere, right? And there's this guy named Nagarjuna who presented these texts. And the story is, you can see in the picture there, they're called Nagas. Nagas are underwater snake creatures that have been keeping the teachings of Mahayana Buddhism safe for all these centuries because people were not ready yet for them. Right? And so they emerge out of the water and give the texts to Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna then gives the teaching of the Bodhisattva. What is the Bodhisattva? Well, I'm glad you asked because I'm going to tell you. So according to those texts, and so this is just straight out of those texts, what is the Bodhisattva? Someone is called a Bodhisattva if he's certain to become a Buddha being a man who is first enlightened himself and will thereafter enlighten others. Clear? Next one. The question now arises, from what date onward he can justifiably be called a Bodhisattva? This change from an ordinary being to a Bodhi being takes place when his mind has reached the stage that it can no longer turn back from enlightenment. Also, he has by then gained 5 advantages. He's no more born in states of woe. That's a reference to the 6 possible births that Buddhism teaches from the Wheel of Becoming. But always born among gods and men, he is never again born in poor or low-class families. He is always male and never a woman. He is always well-built and free from physical defects, and he can remember his past lives and no more forgets them again. Okay, so these texts are from like the 1st and 2nd century of the Common Era. Okay, so we're talking about like 600 or 700 years after the life of the Buddha. Okay, next slide there. Now, once a Bodhisattva has been recognized and acknowledged, you know it through a vow that they take, right? So a Bodhisattva makes a vow. And this comes from the Bodhisattvacharya Avatara Sutra. And that means the great teacher Bodhisattva incarnation verses. That's what that means. So just as all the previous Sujatas, the Buddhas, generated the mind of enlightenment and accomplished all the stages of the Bodhisattva training, so will I too, and here's your phrase, for the sake of all sentient beings, generate the mind of enlightenment and accomplish all the stages of the Bodhisattva training. So the purpose of the Bodhisattva is now for the good of all sentient beings. Right? And what does that word sentient mean? It means thinking, perceiving, feeling. Okay, so it actually extends past humanity to actually all the living life forces of the cosmos. Right? So it's a beautifully inclusive term, which is why I love it. Next one, please. Now, here's someone you might recognize, the 14th Dalai Lama. He's commenting on that Bodhisattva vow. He says, moved by, and here you go, compassion, karuna, Bodhisattvas take the vow to liberate all sentient beings. Then by overcoming their self-centered outlook, remember what the original question was, right? They engage eagerly and continuously in the very difficult practices of accumulating merit and insight. Having entered into this practice, they will certainly complete the collection of merit and insight. Next one. Accomplishing the accumulation of merit and insight is like having omniscience itself in the palm of your hand. Therefore, since compassion is the only root of omniscience, you should become familiar with this practice from the very beginning. And I would actually say, and I very much agree with the Dalai Lama on this, you'd be glad to know, that I think what he's saying in some way is, what I'll try to put in my own language, is that you can have a double doctorate from the best university in the world and be a complete and utter fool. That's true, you know. You can have all kinds of knowledge, but you don't have wisdom. So there's actually a difference between wisdom and knowledge, right? And knowledge is as you'd imagine, it's about knowing stuff. It's about knowing things. It's about understanding systems and things like that. But wisdom is all about character. And I would even say, and I think the Dalai Lama would very much say the same thing, the highest wisdom is compassion. Highest wisdom is compassion. That when we approach life from a self-centered perspective, we snip the reasoning abilities in our own brains. So we're not able to think clearly, right? The more self-centered we are. But the wiser through compassion that we are, the more that we get connected up. We become fully integrated with ourselves and also the people around us. By the way, what's this picture here? Did you know that the Dalai Lama is believed to be the incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion, the Bodhisattva of compassion? Okay, so that giggly monk that she knows, the Dalai Lama, in Vajrayana belief is the Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig in Tibetan. Okay, next one. Now, some of you, I could hear this gasp. When we read that the Bodhisattva is never a female, yeah? 7 centuries later, fast forward, and I let you just gasp that just for the kid, let you sit with that moment there. So remember that text, he's always male and never a woman. Well, let me introduce you to Tara. Tara, the green Tara. Tara means star in Sanskrit. And she is now... So moving on 7 centuries later from even the development of Mahayana, she is the female embodiment of Bodhisattva, right? So she's also referred to sometimes as the mother of the Buddhas. And why have I told you this? Because what I've wanted to show you is that though the depth charge was set in the life of the Buddha, the ripple effect has gone out from there. And compassion moves things forward. Right? And so lived and living traditions are always emerging like this. Right? Now, if we had the whole package, you know, fait accompli in, you know, the 6th century BCE, well, there would be nothing to add to it. There would be nothing to think through in your own time and place. But each one of these Buddhist teachers had to think through what the tradition means now, next generation, and now. And now, and so a lived and living tradition is always emerging and always rethinking. Okay? Now, where's the comparative stuff? I'm glad you asked, because here we are. Meanwhile, in the womb of another mother, Mary, mother of Jesus, she would later become known as the Theotokos, the God-bearer, or some people would call her the mother of God. Nestorius hated that term. The Nestorians were like, no, she's not the mother of God, she's the mother of the human incarnation of God. Well, the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church just lets that sit there with you. All right, next slide. So here we have another, that moment, that depth charge, right? Something happened, right? And so the Eastern, especially the Eastern Orthodox tradition, likes to depict this as happening in a cave. Right, so in the womb and in the cave, and the whole idea is the creator himself is born in the depths of his own creation. Right? And so that's the depth charge of history. And, you know, whether you like it or not, history is hinged B.C. A.D. Now, that's what we used to say, before Christ and A.D. Anno Domini. Now, of course, not Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. He's not everybody's Lord. So nowadays we say B.C.E., before the Common Era and the Common Era. However way you look at it, he hinged history. Right? So there's this depth charge thing going on. There's this drop in the lake, and now the ripples going out. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And that's what Christmas is all about. You know, I was in the mall the other day with everyone else, seemingly all of Thunder Bay, and we were in one of those, I can't remember the name, it was one of those really smelly stores, you know, soaps and all that kind of stuff. I can't say, it gives me a headache, those places. And the sign at the front said, "What Christmas smells like." And I'm like, oh, I hope not. Because it's like this mix of all this horrible perfume, right? And I thought about that. What does Christmas smell like? It smells like cow dung. It smells like the stable. It smells like the cave. It smells like the messiness of childbirth. Right? And I think we need to not forget that. We need to not forget the messiness of Christmas. And that's what Christmas smells like, because it's a picture of how Christ comes into our own lives. He comes into our mess. He comes into our sin. He comes into our self-centeredness. And being born in there heads our life in a totally new direction. It's the watershed moment. Right? So, it's a little Christmas meditation for you. Also, the Gospel of Matthew likes this term, Emmanuel. Emmanuel, which means God with us. And if you notice, the Gospel of Matthew is bookended with this concept of God being present with us. So it begins with this announcement to Joseph, "Behold, the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. So that concept of God being here with us, not out there somewhere in some alternate universe called heaven, but here with us in the midst of what we are in the midst of, in the mess, in the stable, in the cow dung, in all of that kind of stuff, right? God is here with us. And then look at the very last verse of the Gospel of Matthew. As Jesus is sending his disciples out, he says, "Teach them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, Emmanuel is still with you, even unto the end of the age." So that presence, and it's harkening back to the temple idea of the presence of God in the midst of people, the Shekinah glory. Okay, next one. All right, coming in for a landing here. How are we doing? Doing okay? All right. So one of the things, remember, if this Jesus was born into the mess, and not into the palace, but into poverty, right? How do we know he was born into poverty? Because he was redeemed with two turtle doves, right? So when that he, as a firstborn, was presented at the temple, right? The poor would come with the presentation of two doves, two birds, right? They couldn't afford bigger livestock, right? So this is how we know that Jesus was born into relative poverty. And his message, who did he appeal to? Of course, to the poor, as he says, the least of these. Right? When you clothe, when you feed, when you visit in prison, when you give a glass of water, you're doing it unto me, because there I am in the least of these, my brethren. Right? So there's this amazing passage, Matthew 25, you could read. That's a story for another time as well. But the tradition of that would become known as Christianity is birthed among the poor. Right? It's birthed among the poor. It's birthed among the slaves. It's birthed among the unclean and the outsider. Yeah, this is just historical fact. Now, as a result, you've got slaves coming into this new tradition, and you've got the Apostle Paul having to explain, well, what do you do if you're a slave? What do you do if you come into this into this new way, but you're still in your old and very painful and very oppressive circumstances? Ephesians 6, Paul says this, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters, fear and trembling and singleness of heart, as you obey Christ, not only while being watched in order to please them, but as slaves of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. Peter says this, slaves, accept the authority of your masters with all deference, not only those who are kind and gentle, but also those who are harsh. Why did the apostles not foment a slave revolt? If you think about that, would that have worked? Here are people without any political power, any economic power. And basically what he said to these followers, these faithful followers, is you incarnate Jesus in whatever your life circumstances are. Okay, 1 Corinthians 7, Paul goes on to say, were you a bondservant when you were called? Okay, don't be concerned about it. But look at this. He's not saying slavery is a fully justifiable and good socioeconomic practice. He says, if you can get your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. If you can get free, go for it. But you don't have any political power, so what are you going to do? Incarnate Jesus to them. That's what he's saying. Revelation 18 is this amazing, weird, and wacky kind of horrifying sort of text, if you ever get a chance to read it. The end, it talks about the fall of Babylon. And it talks about how Babylon, when the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for Babylon. Why? Because there's no one buys her cargo anymore. And what is it? What is included among the stuff that Babylon buys and sells? Well, you've got all this, you know, the stuff for the market, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses and chariots, and what else? Slaves. It's the trading in human souls, right? This is part of the Babylon system, right? And this is a tradition of hope for a people that were that really desperately needed it. Okay, let's fast forward. So a lot of people are kind of critical about Christianity to say, yeah, well, it didn't actually dismantle the slave trade, right? But think about it in context, right? And then move forward a few years. Fast forward another three centuries, Asia Minor, 4th century. I'd like to introduce you to Santa Claus. That is the original Santa Claus, right? Saint Nicholas of Myra. And he is known, there's this famous story of, he knew of three daughters that were about to be sold into slavery and into the sex trade because they didn't have a dowry, right? So they were part of this culture that needed, and it was very much like modern day India as well, where daughters needed a dowry in order to get married off and married off well. So what does Nicholas do? While they're sleeping, he drops some gold into their house, and the daughters are saved. Right? So this story becomes this very well-known story. And Nicholas was known as being a gift giver. And not just a gift giver, but a secret gift giver. People would receive gifts from him, and at night while the children are sleeping, right? And go, where did this come from? Right? And Nicholas would be like, I don't know, hey. Thank God. Right? And so this is eventually how the story grows. Next one. You want to know how he got Christmas trees? Well, the answer is St. Boniface with an axe. Okay, so St. Boniface with an axe, he'd had enough of seeing children being sacrificed at the sacred oak of Thor. So what did he do? He went and took an axe and he chopped down that sacred oak of Thor. And just to basically to say, see, nothing bad's going to happen to me, and this practice of child sacrifice has to stop. And so instead, he chops down a little tree, a fir tree, right? And he says, this little fir tree, a young child of the forest, shall be your holy tree tonight. It's the wood of peace. It's the sign of an endless life, for its leaves are evergreen. See how it points upward to heaven. Let this be called the tree of the Christ child. Gather about it, not in the wild wood, but in your own homes. And there it shall shelter no deeds of blood, but loving gifts and rites of kindness. So these are some of the roots of these traditions, right? But you can see how the tradition that began that in that depth charge in Bethlehem is kind of spreading out and thinking itself and rethinking itself and emerging as it goes. Next one. Fast forward another millennium, and here you have a guy by the name of William Wilberforce. And here's the question that he has to ask. Remember, Buddhism had to ask its own key questions. Now, what happens when the former religion of the slaves becomes the religion of the slavers? right? This is the question that William Wilberforce has to ask. And his answer is, we have to repent, right? And so look what he says here. I determined to forget all my other fears, and I march forward with a firmer step in the full assurance that my cause will bear me out, and that I shall be able to justify upon the clearest principles every resolution in my hand. He was a member of Parliament, by the way, so he was very rhetorical. The avowed end of which is the total abolition of the slave trade. This is what an incarnational disciple of Jesus does. This is what he does in his day and age. What happens when the slave religion becomes the slaver's religion? He says, we are all guilty. We ought to all plead guilty. Let's remove that plank from our own eye first before we can help the Portuguese with the speck in theirs or the Spanish with the speck in theirs. Right? And so he worked tirelessly. And as the story goes, the bill was passed to abolish slavery in the British Empire just a few days before he died. So how's that for a gift for your life pursuit? Why? Because his living traditions are always rethinking themselves. Right? So here he goes. Here the divine doctrine is contradicted by the reverse action. And here's your word. The compassion. That compassion is the great source of humanity. Surely the principles of Christianity lead to action as well as meditation. And look. Look what he's quoting in his letter to Parliament here. He's quoting from Colossians and from Acts. It says, there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision or uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free, but Christ is all and in all. Put on, therefore, and I love this phrase, bowels of mercies. Yeah? That's good old King James English. Bowels of mercies, a.k.a. compassion. Right? Because it's the stuff that wells up from deep inside of you, from the very depths of who you are. Right? That Christ is born in the cave of who you are. Right? And out of the bowels of mercies comes compassion that you can give to the world. Right? So, this, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to see traditions rethinking themselves and renewing themselves. Fast forward, here we are, almost come to an end. Fast forward another half a century. On the momentum of what Wilberforce had accomplished, there was a shockwave that went throughout the colonies. Originally, there was a French Christmas poem written in 1847, and it became known as O Holy Night. And it was translated by abolitionists and became a Christmas song by 1855. So this was 6 years before the American Civil War, 8 years before the Emancipation Proclamation. O Holy Night made popular in the Union States. And here's, this is really important. It was a song both of worship and of political resistance and protest. And this is a way, like, when you hear O Holy Night this Christmas season, think of it as this. Next one. Think of that verse. Truly he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel is peace. Chains shall he break, for the slave is our brother. And in his name, all oppression shall cease. Can you see the tradition rethinking itself? Emerging in each generation. Compassion moving it forward. Right? So while the Apostle Paul didn't say all this in the New Testament, the depth charge was there. The watershed moment had happened. The ripple effects have now been felt throughout history and continue to be felt throughout history. Right? So just as with Buddhism, Christianity is rethinking itself. It's in an age where it has to rethink itself. As traditional church doesn't work anymore, and as young people leave the church and people are wondering where's everybody going, it will rethink itself. Right? And actually just this last week, the flagship magazine for evangelical Christianity, Christianity Today, said, impeach this guy. Let's get him out of there. That takes guts. Like, imagine they are risking losing like millions of their readers. But it's a tradition that's rethinking itself. That's saying compassion is going to move us forward, right? And this is what it looks like in Christmas 2019. Next one. Lived and living traditions are like trees. Ancient yet new, rooted yet adapting, wise but still learning, still bearing fruit, the fruit of compassion. And I'll end with this, a Christmas wish for blessing and compassion for all of you. And here you see my sources, glory to God in highest and on earth peace, goodwill toward, This is from Luke 2:14, all sentient beings from the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara Sutra. Blessings and abundance on all of you.